Graham Smith, author of Deadly Dogma, How Neoconservatives Broke the Law to Deceive America. It happens to be the very best book that I have seen or read that exposes the crimes of those who brought us the war in Iraq, who have led the push for U.S. attack on Iran, and who in fact brought us the concept of the axis of evil. If Grant's name sounds familiar to you, it should be, though. I interviewed him on Takes on the World on August 3rd and realized afterward we only had begun to scratch the surface of this very important subject that not only the mainstream but most of the alternative media has relegated to the shadows, even as the neocons remain as dangerous to the future of our planet as ever. Grant Smith is the Director of Research at the Institute for Research, Middle Eastern Policy, or IRMEP, a Washington-based nonprofit organization. His analysis and research have appeared in the Financial Times, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Reuters News Service, the Associated Press, and in the State Department's specialty publication, Washington File. Welcome Grant Smith back to Takes on the World.
Thank you very much, Jeff. I'm really honored to be on the program again and getting the word out. Over KZYX.
As a special so-called bipartisan panel headed by James Baker III tries to find a way out of Iraq between W's stay the course and immediate withdrawal, I'd like to go back to the role of the neoconservatives in getting the U.S. into Iraq in the first place and how the decision of George Bush Sr. not to unseat Saddam in 1991 turned the neocons against him. And Bush's decision seemed to be ironically a catalyst for the coming together of the project of New American Century, or PNAC, and I say ironically because it was Bush who was the one who, as I recall, spoke of a new world order.
Yes, absolutely. I think, you know, it's a key turning point to look at the letter that was sent to Bill Clinton by the group of PNACers, who include, obviously, the authors of this war, Elliot Abrams, Jeffrey Bergner, Francis Fukuyama, Robert Kagan, including William Crystal, Donald Rumsfeld, and Paul Wolfowitz. When they put into a formal letter that in January 26, 1998, asking Clinton to go beyond containing Saddam Hussein, they were putting their name on a document which they had all of their intentions clearly listed in terms of military efforts on the part of the U.S. in the region. And they were, at that point, ready to go, but simply needed a pretext.
Well, in your book, you actually, from the PNAC people, you actually have a breakdown of how they ended up in the government, of George Bush the Jr.
Right. Well, Deadly Dogma looks at how each of these migrated into positions in the administration, whether it's David Wormser, who migrated into Cheney's office as a key policy advisor, or Richard Perle, who stayed kind of on the outside by being the chair of the Defense Policy Board so that he could also pursue his interests in benefiting from the coming bonanza to military contractors that the invasion would trigger. But I think at the core, Deadly Dogma is revealing the weakness of our system of democracy, in which no matter who you vote for, unless you're a major behind-the-scenes player at the top of the party hierarchy, you don't influence the choice of policymakers who are brought into the administration or the behind-the-scenes activities that they take a place take part in. So Deadly Dogma attempts to list the current group of individuals who we feel are both highly compromised and many have violated various laws, who've rotated into this presidential administration and continue to influence it.
Well, just to go to that PNAC list, you have William Crystal, who we see all the time on Fox with his ever smiling face. giving the neocon perspective as if that is the normal, what used to be called the conservative perspective. You have Dick Cheney's become the vice president, Rumsfeld secretary of defense, Wolfowitz was deputy defense secretary, now he's at the World Bank, Elliot Abrams, Libby, who was Cheney's chief of staff, Bolton of the State Department, and I was curious when Greg Palast said that sending Bolton to the UN was a demotion. We see what the role he's played there. And then
Salmeh Khalilzad, the ambassador to Iraq.
Right, that's another one. And you never see that the reference is actually to Khalilzad. It's never mentioned in the New York Times, the Washington Post, or the mainstream media that he was a part of that PNAC, and he was one of the signatories to that letter to
no.
Clinton.
No, absolutely not.
Never mentioned.
No, and I think that gets back into the larger debate of some of the massive behind-the-scenes subsidies that people like William Crystal get. David Brooks is another sort of softer image of the neoconservative worldview who's endlessly on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer to give his analysis of what's going on internationally. And I think that's the difference between stations and broadcast outlets that are actually trying to get behind the scenes and produce some more daring programs about what's going on, as opposed to merely trying to buttress and defend viewpoints that they've had for years, no matter what the consequences.
Well, it's interesting, when William Safire retired from the New York Times, they brought on David Brooks, and readers, you know, they didn't know where he was coming from.
No.
They didn't know he was a columnist for the Weekly Standard, the neocon house organ, and so it's like an infiltration into what they call the paper of record. That's all the news that fits the print, as if he's just another independent columnist.
Right.
And there's no knowledge of his agenda. And this is the kind of thing, actually, when Anthony Lewis left, they brought in, who was the last, maybe the genuine liberals, they brought in Tom Friedman.
Right.
Who's not a neocon, but he is the supposedly the good cop, which just shows how far to the right the whole spectrum has moved.
Well, there really should be kind of a regulation FD, which, you know, in the financial world, that's disclosure to stockholders of material information about their stock. We should have kind of a regulation FD that says, look, this is David Brooks. He's been financed at the Weekly Standard or whatever paper by News Corporation, not because of the quality of his journalism, but because he's part of this larger group that's towing the line in terms of Middle East policy, in terms of military policy, and he's what the ownership likes. I mean, if you comb through, and this is something that some of the people who obtained a copy of Deadly Dogma can do in the chapter on media networks, if you comb through some of the statements of owners of major corporate media and the policy lines that they forthrightly state are going to be followed because the buck stops with ownership, you find that in spite of getting on a public television program like the NewsHour, David Brooks has been very deeply involved in receiving money of other neoconservative pundits and continues to do that. His viewpoints have proven to be wrong over and over again, but there's never an accountability moment for people, particularly those financed by Conrad Black, Rupert Murdoch, and other enablers who have really been behind the push to get neoconservative talking heads out into the mainstream news stream.
Well, you have in New York, besides the New York Times, which may have put Brooks in there to avoid further criticism from the neocons as being soft on terror, not sufficiently supportive of Israel and so on. But the New York Post used to be a progressive daily. Mm-hmm. It had liberal to left credentials, and now the New York Post, of course, is owned by Murdoch, and you have the New York Daily News, which has always been something my school teacher in New York said you use in the bathroom, owned by Mortimer Zuckerman, who's the former chair of the presidents of major Jewish organizations, the owner of the U.S. News and World Report, who wrote editorial after editorial calling for the war in Iraq. And you talk about that with Zuckerman, and you quote him in your book.
Yeah, absolutely. Mortimer Zuckerman went ballistic when a highly respected scholar, Mazen Kumsayev, I believe he was of Yale University, managed to get some content into the Davos-sponsored magazine Global Agenda, which raised the issue of the Israel-Palestine conflict as a major issue and even touched on the idea of a boycott similar to that of South Africa. Mortimer Zuckerman absolutely denounced any alternative viewpoint like that, particularly at a Davos-sponsored event, and furthermore stated that within his own constellation of news media, such as U.S. News and World Report, that, quote, as a publisher, I have to take full responsibility for everything that appears in my publications, whether I read them or not, unquote. That means the readers of these so-called mainstream news magazines will never get a view that does not toe the preconceived notions of Mortimer Zuckerman and U.S. Middle East policy. It's just not going to happen.
Well, you also have a quote in your book from the editor of Chicago Sun-Times, who is also involved with the Jerusalem Report, about what would or wouldn't be run in the commitment to support Israel. Actually, you have six deadly dogmas listed, and I want to go through those, but one of those is the primacy of Israel in the whole neocon worldview, and how Israel relates to the United States in terms of U.S. hegemony. Maybe you could talk about that a bit.
Right. Well, in our research, when we first started really looking at neoconservative doctrine back in 2002, it always circled back to this idea that if you're going to be a major policymaker and a major force for U.S. Middle East policy, you've got to have the primacy of Israel and an unquestioned view of its importance to the U.S. as kind of an a priori devotion. Otherwise, you won't be taken seriously and you'll be blocked from any significant policymaking position. If you look through the statements of Condoleezza Rice, of Donald Rumsfeld, in their past as kind of a way to signal, they've all attributed Middle East conflict to be the fault of the Palestinians. They've continuously upheld that international law should not determine any settlement in terms of territory or compensation to the Palestinians driven out of their homes in 1948 during the creation of the state. And they, no questioning whatsoever of the history of the violence that has continued to this day. So an a priori commitment to the idea of an Israel that's expansive, that is a dominant military force, and above and beyond United Nations resolution has been a key to getting into the highest administration positions. And it's another part of this sort of behind-the-scenes filtering that goes on and produces consistently incapable and non-representative policymakers who invariably have a notion about what to do in the region that is at odds with even mainstream surveyed U.S. opinion about U.S. Middle East policy, which is much more humanitarian aid-oriented and much more oriented, according to the latest surveys, toward helping in disaster release and realizing national aims of depressed people. So in order to get that kind of radical and divergent view, which is actually not all that widespread, you've got to signal your willingness to embrace the primacy of Israel as a cost of getting into those policy positions or as your wholesale belief.
Well, it's interesting, you have a quote at the beginning of that dogma number five, uh-huh, the primacy of Israel, which I'll quote, and I remember when she said it, 2 months after the George W. Bush launched the war in Iraq, Condoleezza Rice said, quote, "The security of Israel is the key to security of the world." Now, that's a very scary thought.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting quote, and also the fact that she's got a deep affinity.
Yes.
Again, I think that most Americans would ask for deep affinity with U.S. interests and would maybe hearken back to thinkers such as George Washington, who advised against any sort of passionate attachment in our foreign policy. But those types of, as someone once said, those types of fish have been largely driven out from the think tanks, which have been seeded strategically with a type of unquestioning mindset that no longer looks at international law, no longer looks at national liberation movements or the questions of occupation. A lot of those thinkers have been driven out, and none of those thinkers are present in the current Bush administration.
Well, speaking of not in the Bush administration, but it might as well be, the headline the other day in the New York Times, Joe Lieberman complaining that Ned Lamont, who defeated him in the Democratic primary, did not have a sufficient commitment to Israel, which is very strange, because when politicians can openly say that and get away with it. I want to go back into the book here, starting with that first dogma of strike first, the preemptive strike, and you have the first strike theory, which is not only very important where you place it in the book, but also because it is really based on Israel's first strike in 1967, on the morning of June 6th,
right?
That of on Egypt, and you have what I've never seen before, and actually a document that everyone should read is U.S. government papers, messages that were transmitted back and forth in the Johnson administration before the 67 war, which indicated that Egypt was not about to go to war and that the U.S. was more interested in a diplomatic solution than having Israel attack, but felt they were restrained to the point that were restrained from restraining Israel. And this was, to me, something I wasn't even aware had been released.
No, it's gotten virtually no notification in the mainstream news. It was on C-SPAN. I was at the State Department on January 12, 2004 when they released it. It's a series of cables from the Office of the Historian which show rather definitively the U.S.'s role in trying to avoid a conflict, mentioning that they were trying to hold the Israeli tiger and also arranging a visit from an Egyptian diplomat to negotiate the final winding up of the confrontation that was taking place with the movement of various troops and military assets. The lesson of the War of 1967, if it's written properly, and it has not yet been written properly in the most important books, such as Michael Oren's book about the Six-Day War, which doesn't even mention this document, would show that preemption removes options from the table, that the idea of striking first sometimes means that you guarantee a conflict which otherwise would not occur. And in fact, the lessons of 1967, which we go into detail here and also present the source document because it's never appeared in any book, are important lessons for today. Yesterday, in fact, we've heard that we're pre-positioning assets in space now under a new policy which goes above and beyond the 1967 Outer Space Treaty, which bars any states from pre-positioning weapons in space. And we're also declaring that space will be off limits to any challengers who might have views different than those of the United States interests, who might want to have their own development for capabilities and options in space. So the neoconservative doctrine of preemption, which puts a hair trigger on military responses and guarantees conflicts which might not occur if proper diplomacy is in place, continue to this day to drive preposition of military assets and, more importantly, take away options in terms of putting a hair trigger in many new realms which were previously off limits to any sort of militarization or any sort of conflict buildup.
It also dictates the policy of not speaking to the enemy, so to speak, whereas the first Bush administration talked with Damascus there's tremendous pressure on the Bush administration from the lobby here, from the pro-Israel lobby, not to speak with Damascus now they can, or talk to Iran. And, of course, with the axis of evil, which David Frum, another neocon, Canadian neocon, who's rarely identified as being Canadian, bringing Korean, North Korea into it, even James Baker, not known for his progressive politics, the third said you have to talk to the enemy.
Right, right. He said that last week, in fact. And it's sort of a rejection by the paleocons to the neocon idea of the moral high ground. If you're a neoconservative and you depend on what they would call neo-Wilsonian ideals, which depend upon enforcement by U.S. power, then you believe that there's no such thing as international law. You believe that your moral primacy trumps that of adversaries so that you no longer need to talk to them. You rely on getting that message out to form constituencies and manufactured consent in the media. And in short, you put a hair trigger response on policy, which will always rely on military options as opposed to understanding that other parts of the world are different than the United States, and that they don't think the same way that we do. I think it's notable, and we didn't mention it in the book, just how little international experience many of these neoconservatives have. They're sort of like George Bush, who rarely, if ever, had traveled outside of the United States and lived any significant period abroad to understand that fundamental fact that not everybody thinks the same way as the United States.
Well, they brought with them a lot of ideological baggage that blinded them to any, you know, external experiences, and they're not the first group of people who had ideology blind them to external experiences, even with other people, other political persuasions.
No, that's true, and I think that's the danger of the coming election. We could certainly write about a group that's as rabidly blinded on the Democratic side that's chomping at the bit to bring their dogma back into power, whether it's Martin Indyk or Dennis Ross, people who have a track record of failure, who are primarily buttressed by massive amounts of money from limited, narrow interest groups, who would like to crowd out the expertise and judgment of genuine scholars, of whom there's a surplus in the U.S. in universities, with the deadly dogma from their particular think tank on Massachusetts Avenue. So, One of the failures we wish to point out in this book, so that Americans at some point will go beyond plank in terms of policy formulation and actually say, now we're going to talk about who's actually qualified to implement policy in our chosen administration should it become elected. For whatever reason, negligence or the fact that people are just not interested beyond the policy platform, there's a massive impetus to get the wrong people in the wrong positions in any administration.
Let's go to the second dogma, unlimited military spending. This is extraordinary because both political parties have fallen into the neocon line of unlimited military spending, with a few exceptions. There is no movement in the Democratic Party even to stop this spending. And you show an ad here from Boeing's Osprey mosque attack, mm-hmm. from the Natural Journal magazine. It shows obviously an Arab town and a mosque, and it shows the Osprey helicopter, which can go up vertically, and it says, the caption, it descends from heaven, ironically, and unleashes hell.
Yes, I think that ad says so much about how, even though theoretically we now know that terrorism and asymmetric warfare is on the increase precisely because of the United States' overwhelming conventional and strategic military might, that the marketing within the buyers of this high-tech equipment continue to buttress the line of military might, as if that was effective on 9/11 and as if it were affected in the ongoing carnage in Iraq. What we now know, thanks to bloody experience, that you can have as many V-22 Ospreys as you want, a big, cumbersome, lumbering beast of a helicopter/airplane. I've seen them flying off the Chesapeake Bay. And that doesn't necessarily mean that the ideologically motivated welder of an RPG who really wants to get the U.S. out of their territory isn't going to prevail. There's this unquestioned and simplistic sense that the more money you dump into massive military spending, particularly for high-tech solutions that don't necessarily address asymmetric warfare and certainly don't address the causes that drive it, that's somehow going to make America safer. So to be a neoconservative, you absolutely have to toe the line put forth by people such as Frank Gaffney and Richard Pearl, that almost any weapon system, whether as long as it's big, especially like missile defense, is going to be better than negotiations, it's going to be better than treaties and arms limitation treaties, and it's going to be better than any sort of approach that attempts to deal with the causes. Military spending, in a sense, is a way of running away from the root causes of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which have to do with land, they have to do with justice, they have to do with a resolution to a conflict. The idea is that that might makes right, and by having unlimited military capacities and denying to any upstart the approaching the level of the U.S., that you can have safety and security. And as we state, that's a dogma. That's something that if you repeat it long enough, some people might believe it, but it's not actually true.
Well, it's interesting. It violates even the laws of capitalism, of supply and demand, because there's really no demand, and the U.S. is a purchaser with taxpayers' money for weapons that will never be used.
Right.
These F-22 stealth fighters, initially funded at a couple of $1 billion, there was criticism about going on and building them because there's no competitive fighter being made by anybody.
No, and that's this is an example of where those who are continually stressing the solution of markets and capitalism get it wrong, because again, there is no competitive market for these weapons. The way that they're negotiated and purchased is almost anti-competitive. And you also have the same manufacturers feeding into the policy stream. In fact, on page 61, I confronted Rugger, the CEO of Northrop Grumman, and I said, why don't you just tell us how much money you give the American Enterprise Institute and which scholars you're subsidizing? And he refused to disclose that. You'd think that a public company that had shareholders would disclose a line item like that, but they won't. So there's also a negative feedback loop that almost guarantees that the high-tech, high-cost, elegant solutions will predominate over more effective approaches, both military and non-military, that could be that could actually make America safer.
Well, this book of yours is replete with comments and quotations. You talk about the neocons lining their pockets. As a little side effect of the military spending, and one of the critical ones, of course, is dogma number 6, which we see expressed in the White House all the time: international law is non-binding.
Right. To be a neoconservative, you've got to take the view that international law, as Eric Posner at the University of Chicago said, is just a part of international politics. You'll find that in conservative talk radio and now across all the cable networks, people denigrate the UN, they denigrate the United Nations, and meanwhile they're perfectly willing to jump on an international flight or make an international phone call, which depend upon telecom protocols and all sorts of international agreements simply to get cargo and air passengers from one place to the other. You don't hear them denigrating that, but the things that are inconvenient, there's a massive campaign to cancel not only the space conventions, but also the chemical weapons convention that was led by Frank Gaffney. And you can really see how much he stood to benefit personally, as well as the sort of intermediation role as a broker he thought he could create for himself by having that very useful treaty canceled. Now, most people don't want stockpiles of chemical weapons and anthrax and botulinum and smallpox to be part of anyone's weapon program. But yet he saw that the market for antidotes and for other types of value-added industries is so great, and that his role as a broker could be so important, that he was active in lobbying to cancel that, and was finally brought down by a number of sensible Republicans who said, no, that's the type of unlimited law-breaking and military spending that not even we can condone. But you know, the idea that international law is non-binding, and that the only thing that matters is that which can be backed up by might, along with the Collarian dogma that the U.S. will always be the most mighty, really puts international relations on the crudest footing, which is simply that might makes right.
You have a history of neocon espionage, of Pearl, Wolfowitz, Feith, Ledeen, Steve Bryan, people who have been caught passing secrets on to Israel, and have had a slap on the wrist. You have a breakdown, you have a very excellent comparison of the neocons with the mafia and the kind of duties they carry out.
Right.
You have in the book here the Clean Break document, which was created by Richard Pearl, Douglas Feith, Murad Worms, among others, advising Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, and his policy in the Middle East, which would be to take out all the regimes that were contrary to Israel and stop negotiating with the Palestinians.
Right.
And it ends up being U.S. policy, in practice. And to have the documents to be able to quote is extraordinary. Grant, again, we're still scratching the surface here. I appreciate having you as our guest. Grant, glad to have you back again, and we'll do it again.
Thanks, Jeffrey.
Take care.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.